Blog Talk Radio.
Colorado, and my name is Paula Thompson, and you are with us on Blog Talk Radio and The Cosmic Citizen. With me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Crystalline Beek Larson and Andre Rodatis. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Oh, it is so good to hear your voices, as always.
Well, likewise.
Good to be here.
And we are here, and we have a wonderful guest today. Thank you, Crystalline, for putting together this show. And a return guest, Dr. Frank Kaufman, is on with us. And we love to talk about peacemaking. You know, that was what Jesus talked about and held up high as being something that the children of God would do. Blessed are the peacemakers. And you know, Frank is an incredible, amazing interfaith worker. And Crystalline, would you mind saying a little bit more about our guest and what you guys want to talk about today?
Sure. Well, first of all, this is Frank's second time being on the program with us. And the last time he was here, he came on right after we had Mark Siljander on, mm-hmm. and we were talking about interfaith understanding between Christianity and Islam. And we talked about some of the work that Frank, or I should call him Dr. Kaufman, has done around the world in really stressful, war-torn parts of the world. And he talked a little bit about some of the really successful experiences he had had in, or kind of down to the wire, situations of great stress and strife and what it was like to have major breakthroughs. And I'm hoping that today we'll get to talk about a little more of the diverse types of work that Dr. Kaufman is involved in. And It's always a pleasure to have him on the show because he's just such a warm and humble and accessible, friendly guy to talk to. It's no wonder you're such a great peacemaker, Frank. Welcome to the show.
Welcome. Thank you very much. Glad to be here. Glad to be back. Thank you all. I enjoyed myself with you last time we were together, and I look forward to spending a little time with you today again.
Well, welcome to the show.
We called you a true cosmic citizen, Frank.
Okay.
Never truer words were spoken. I mean, you really embody the whole purpose of this show and the whole meaning of that phrase, cosmic citizen. You're the future. I think in the future people will be like you, you know, integrated in their thinking and accepting of other religions and even willing to cross borders and boundaries to reach out a hand in love and friendship.
And I'd like to give my real quick synopsis of what strikes me as this beautiful juxtaposition that in maybe one sentence describes Frank to me better than anything else, and that is that he's the founder and president of Interreligious Federation for World Peace and so many other things, and at the same time is a man who loves to lie in the grass and stare up at the clouds. To me, that says it all. That says the child is alive in you, Frank. That child craves peace.
Thank you very much, Andre. You know, as you were mentioning that, what I thought was what would be more remarkable is somebody that tries to affect peace and doesn't do that. That would be an unusual figure to have on your show.
Well, you know, in order to create peace, you have to be peace, right? I mean, it's interesting that peacemakers who stand on the corner and shout at others is, you know, probably not the way to create peace. I mean, it just occurs to me, in order to make peace, you have to be peace. You have to have peace in your heart. And anger probably doesn't create peace, but, you know, a sincere willingness to meet people on common ground.
And on a technical matter, we're having a lot of background noise from somebody's phone. I don't know if that is...
Pretty quiet on my end.
It's... Sounds like rushing water, sort of. I can barely hear it. Yeah,
sounds like rushing water.
I don't know. I'm in a still environment. There's certainly none of that sound, at least in my environment. If it's my phone, I can try calling back. We could test it that way if you like.
You can try muting each one of us. It might be me, but...
Okay, let me try muting you. No? Frank? It's Frank. Frank?
Oh, should I mute myself?
No. I think it's just a background noise of some sort, maybe from the connection. No doubt, it's probably just a connection, since it's still where you are. It's not real noticeable for me, but
shall I call back in? Let's try that and hope.
Why don't you try that and see? Sometimes we can get a much better connection.
We'll get a better connection.
Yeah, some of our listeners say it's not so bad, but why not?
Let's see. I'll call right back in. Here I go.
All right.
Bro Dave says, I hear water noise. That's what it sounded like to me, too.
Yeah, it could be just the connection that happens sometimes. You know, when the connection's not so good, we sound like we're in a swimming pool, you know,
yeah.
Underwater.
The magnificent technology.
Yeah.
That we all love and adore.
Mm-hmm.
Makes our lives so much easier and infinitely more complicated. That's what I've noticed anyway. Here's Frank again.
Yeah.
Join me, or did we somehow shed it?
It sounds much better to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does.
Good.
Sounds like you.
Right.
It was probably the connection.
Yeah.
I just got out of the shower.
That was the rushing water. Okay.
This was the
okay.
And we knew it was something.
What have you been up to since the last time you were on our show? You've initiated some new projects in terms of interfaith and.
Yes. One long, long overdue, and one that I've stumbled into, and I wonder if I would ever do it again. But the one that's long overdue is that because I've been involved in interfaith for nearly 40 years, for a long time people have been pushing me to write my book or write a book. I've written some books, but I never wrote that one. And as I was talking with Crystalline earlier, I recently taught an intensive doctoral course on interfaith and ecumenical relations. And to prepare for that forced me to kind of put everything I know in order to transmit it. And that actually provided for me the foundation to write that book. So I'm in the middle of writing that. It's called Religion and Peace, The Open Door. So the name of the book is The Open Door. And I'm posting advanced excerpts of chapters and sections and things like that as I write so that people can be with me along the way. And actually that has been helpful to me because I'm a bit social, or as an activist, I'm accustomed to being engaged in what I pursue. And so having a chance to somewhat blog the unfolding of the book has given me the energy to keep going more than the typical isolation that probably constitutes writing books normally. So that's that, and I'd love to talk about it if that's the way the direction of the show. But the other thing that I just got myself wrapped up into is that I have a very close and dear friend who is an internationally renowned soprano singer. And she, too, is a peacemaker and has devoted all her life and talents for the sake of peace and reconciliation and humanitarian causes. And she only sings benefits only. She travels the world. She's sung in very, very dangerous places for the sake of bringing a balm and bringing, you know, lifting the hearts up to divine places. And she's singing in the old people's home, elderly homes, or terminal patients' homes. And so she said that she's in Europe, and I do a lot of work in Luxembourg. My organization has one of its headquarters in Luxembourg. And so, and she said she's there and can sing. So I took up to set up a concert performance for her to sing for two major causes. And that's about to happen in about now 3 weeks. On June 15th, she'll be singing at the L'Église Belair in Luxembourg. And so I know we hadn't talked about this, Crystalline, but you said, what have you been up to lately? And this has been just I never dreamt in a million years that saying, yes, that's great, come sing.
Come sing for peace. For peace. What a concept.
Yeah. But to work at long distances and not really realize everything that I had kind of taken on myself is the shocking thing. And so it's getting close and continues to be scary. But each time it seems more than I can manage, some kind of divine light or spark says, keep going, you know. Or like Tinkerbell, keep clapping, you know. So anyway, this is pretty fresh with me. Oh, and actually, two more things. One was that a friend had traveled and came back from his vacation, and I wanted to grab a moment with him and said, are you out? And we got out and had a little bit of time together. And suddenly he looked at me. He was a friend of 40 years. He looked at me and paused like he had never seen me before, and somehow doing so solved a problem. And that is that Kaplan University, which is a distance learning higher education.
Yeah, it's one of the first online universities, right?
Yeah. They are trying to go international, and they're having a major meeting in New York City, and they needed a keynote speaker to speak on that problem of going international. And my friend, who's a meeting planner, had been trying for 3 or 4 weeks to think of who to get to speak to them. And I guess that's what was happening in his mind as he was staring at me like he had never seen me before. And so yesterday, learned I'll be speaking to Kaplan University to help them with some of the subtleties of cross-cultural and intercultural pitfalls and opportunities and things like that. That was that. And at the same time, John is having his epiphany that Frank would be great to, you know, solve his speaker problem and things like that, I got an email from a colleague from Sudan, and apparently, as you and probably our listeners know, there was a pregnant woman accused of apostasy there and was about to be executed for that in the Sudan. And the Bridges to a Common Ground, that I'm a board member and close to its founder, had sent one of its one of our negotiators there, and he wrote back and said he had received a promise from the head of the Supreme Court that he had secured a stay of that execution. So this was a crazy thrill for me. And in the second, over a pair of hot wings or something like that, I find myself, you know, speaking at the, you know, we'll speak soon, and that a life was saved. And so that's the answer, Crystal, when you said, what have you been up to lately? And those are a couple of kind of happy news and developments for me these days, or yet since yesterday, in fact.
Two lives were saved there.
Yeah.
Wow.
Our colleague, and this might be of interest to your listeners, our colleague in the letter that he wrote us explaining the assurance that he received from the minister and from the Supreme Court justice says, in his closing paragraph to us, says, I don't know why God lets me do such wonderful things. I am a clumsy, crazy American. I lack great intellectual prowess and skill. I'm not a brilliant negotiator or linguist. All of these Arabic names and terms sound like calculus to me. And yet he's the one who, in the midst of a just intense government-level international efforts over this pending execution is the fellow who managed. He writes, God, and he goes, yet God said to me, Jeff, will you go to the Sudan for me? That's that. And so
wow.
When Andre was saying how interesting that we have a peace founder and but a guy who lies in the grass, I mean, this is, those are who the, you know, just you can
that's,
even hear the humility in his own self-reflection.
Mm-hmm.
And,
well, and when God sends you to do something,
that's,
you know
that,
you're
point.
Well you're well supported and it's going to work out. That's
right?
To me, that's the lesson of faith right there.
And the key is to go.
And to go, yeah.
And to
right?
go,
because
yes.
Not everybody God might ask is going to say, oh, the Sudan, sure.
Yeah.
So that's the other big thing. You know, those are the two things. So he's humble and is wondering about God, but maybe God is also telling his story about, hey, I asked this guy, Sudan of all places. And he said, yes, well, that's a surprise. I didn't expect that.
well, how
Paula,
amazing.
Paula has another famous quote from somebody that she likes to use in times like this where God doesn't always call the qualified. He qualifies the called.
Right.
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah, Kenny, I'm not sure who originally said that, but it's so true, you know, that if your heart's not in it, it doesn't matter how qualified you are.
Right.
You know? And if your heart is in it, then you can be qualified for any task, really, I think.
Yeah,
you know,
and I think probably all scriptures make sure that they have a little passage about that, even when God called Moses, huh? He said,
mm-hmm.
I can't speak.
Mm-hmm.
Moses, of all people, now he put up with a lot to try to get the will of God done. 40
yes.
years.
I think the UB calls him the matchless Moses.
Uh-huh.
What a general. What a strategist. What an amazing human being. There's
right.
a whole paper.
And at first didn't think he was up to the had what it took.
Yeah.
As well,
well
as
know,
the ordinary men who became the 12 apostles.
Right.
You know, your comment about the woman who was accused of apostasy brings home a reality, and it's, you know, there's interfaith work and then there's what you do, which is on a different level completely. I mean, and what you're describing, your friend going to Sudan, to put yourselves in harm's way, and we all see the news reports and the documentaries and the stories, and, you know, it would take, and especially as a woman, it would take tremendous courage to go, you know, it's kind of like going into the lion's den, or at least that's what it feels like. Maybe it's not like that at all, but that's
no,
what
it's
been painted.
It in fact is.
It is, okay. Well,
yes,
I know a young man in Pakistan who really touched my heart. He wrote, you know, he had a dream, and in the dream God showed him the word Urantia. And so he searched the internet for it, and he found the fellowship. And because I sit at the end of the phone and, you know, the email, he wrote to me, and he wrote this heartfelt plea about God. He had some very, very sincere questions about God, and the letter was so well written. He was despondent at the time, and so I did my very best to minister to him, and I started sharing my understanding about God, and he was just eating this up, and so he started to read the Urantia book, which, as we know, would be considered apostasy, especially in certain places of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And he was reading it secretly. And his family is fairly prominent in the village where he lived, not, you know, in the central part of Pakistan. And he had a pretty good job and working with his family. And his father found it on his computer and turned him over to the religious police.
Oh, wow. Ooh.
Yeah. And, of course, he escaped and went on the run. He hurt himself really bad, broke his ankle, and spent a month with a broken ankle and no medical attention at all.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, and then he finally was able, because he had a little plot of land, he was able to sell that and get some money to get some medical attention. He's in hiding, essentially, now.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my
gosh. Would love to have to have this book in his hand. So here's a, you know, an interesting, you know, thank goodness this young woman didn't have to pay with her life or apostasy, but it just kind of, I guess, shows what could be considered apostasy, then the things that we take for granted as Americans, that we have the right to believe what we believe.
Mm.
And to read a book that maybe doesn't agree with another book, or maybe it does, or maybe it's different. But we have that right to do that freely. And we wouldn't be, literally the religious police were going to kill him. It's a good thing he escaped. Because you know, he's a young man. He's got his whole life ahead of him. And, you know, I just think about how dangerous the world is and what you do and, you know, your friends do to go into that very real danger to make peace.
Mm.
Well, and isn't it interesting that so often it is people of faith who do go to war against one another when, in fact, they have so much more in common than they have separating them in terms of these doctrines or their rituals or their dogmas or just the religious tradition, that have so much more in common with each other than they do with people who are not of faith around the globe.
Let me get to something about that, but just very quickly, that accomplishment that I described from the Bridges community, that's the group founded by Mark Siljander, who is the one who brings us together on this conversation. So it's Mark's group that once again, you know, by this spiritual means, accomplish another wonderful thing. And so just mention that this is the whole approach to Islam that Congressman Siljander pioneered through his linguistic studies. And if I can, I think that was Paula who was speaking about that we have so much more in common. Was it Paul?
No, that was Crystalline.
Crystalline.
Yeah.
You know, I was involved in the creation of a volume called World Scripture. I don't know if you've ever come across this book, but it's a book of, I think it's about 1,400 pages or so, and it is comparative scriptures of all the world's traditions. Thematically broken down. So if you look up God, like the word God, then you can find out what the native indigenous traditions say, what Christians say, what Sikhs say, what Muslims say. If you look up the word salvation, if you look up the word death, if you look up the word sin, it's thematically organized along classical, spiritual, and theological categories. And then under each title or topic, then you can find out what every single world scripture says about that thing, about that matter. And When you go through this book, it's called World Scripture, a Comparative Anthology of Sacred Texts. When you go through it, you find that exactly what Crystalline said, the enormous commonality in just about every single thing among all the world faiths, and that the differences are very tiny, and yet somehow they've managed to keep us apart, strangely enough, or maybe not so strange, but anyway, I just thought I'd mention that because this text is living proof or substantial proof of exactly that commonly recognized thing that all the faiths have so much in common.
Well, you know,
one of the things
you
talked about. Go ahead, Paula.
Well, I just wanted to point out to our listeners that I just looked that up on Googled World Scripture, and it's in a PDF format. I just downloaded the whole book. Amazing. What
yeah,
a wonderful
amazing
resource.
Yeah, this was a great, it's 800, 900 pages. This is one of the great, you know, there were 23 leading theological and ecclesiastical leaders from just the leaders who took responsibility to provide the appropriate scriptures according to the editor's breakdown of how he there were more than one putting the book together. So one is the first one is on God, one is salvation, one is on evil, sin, and the fall, and all these subheadings, and then these 23 major religious leaders from all the different world traditions, including Confucian and Sikh, and they responded by sending back the scriptures from their traditions that they felt spoke most closely to whatever the each thematic topic.
Well, talk about bridges. That really is it.
Yeah, it's a great resource.
Because so often the differences are really almost only semantics.
Yeah. I mean, they're deep and they're real, but they don't need to cause anybody any. They don't need to be in the way of us loving one another. They're so few, and I mean, name any two things that are exactly the same. Two apples. I mean, they're both called apples, but. So we don't somehow humans allow difference to be a source of contention, which I don't see why that's necessary, honestly.
Yeah, you make a good point. The whole point of relationship is really getting to know what are those differences that make us better in community, and also what are those similarities that allow us to function in harmony? And
right. Yeah, you know, I'm sorry. I don't want to interrupt. Sorry.
No, that's okay. I'll just mention there's a quote in the Urantia book on, you know, what are some of the things that would help to bring about a faster or greater realization in any event of the brotherhood of man. And the second point has to do exactly with what you're talking about, and it's called intellectual cross-fertilization.
Mm.
It says, I'll just read this quickly, brotherhood is impossible on a world whose inhabitants are so primitive that they fail to recognize the folly of unmitigated selfishness. There must occur an exchange of national and racial literature. Each race mm-hmm. must become familiar with the thought of all races. Each nation must know the feelings of all nations. Ignorance breeds suspicion, and suspicion is incompatible with the essential attitude of sympathy and love.
Mm. That's beautiful. Beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, and as Andre was saying, that difference is there to help us be attracted to learning more from what we can gain from the one who's different. As he was speaking, I immediately thought of the most radical and absolute difference that I've ever encountered, and how that functions to be an incessant source of interest and attraction to me, and that is the difference between men and women. You can't get much more different than that. And that very difference is like, it's so endlessly fascinating and attractive to me that it's positively a distraction in my life.
So you and almost everybody else on earth.
So now,
if only we could feel that fascinated about people
all
of other faiths or other cultures.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That should be the kind of clue whenever anybody say, well, he's a little different, use that one. Say, you want to know what difference can do?
It makes all the difference.
That's a great analogy.
It is. I love that. Because if men and women can learn to get along, then, you know, and actually join together in the most remarkable of relationships.
Yeah.
For long periods.
And not just
time.
Get along, but just can't stop dreaming about one another.
We continue to intrigue and fascinate one another.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And it's those differences between people that are so intriguing and fascinating. And for people who like people who enjoy getting to know other people and have the understanding that, you know, multiracial, multicultural, multireligious is part of the mix that, you know, makes the soup spicy enough to really enjoy eating.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Somehow we need to translate the obvious things into where somehow we shift gears. Like as you were speaking just now about if you like people or enjoy learning, like most people would think that they can only learn from somebody who they hold up higher or more expertise or something like that. But as you were speaking, I had this image of kind of crouching down and listening to a little 3-year-old explain something to you. And it would be, if you really pay attention, I'm sure you would learn as much as from a professor. I mean, you could be so wrapped in that little one explaining whatever they had on their mind. And, you know, right there again, there's something that tells you, wait a minute, if you don't think there's something to learn, even whether it's a Pakistani Muslim or this, I mean, if you... somehow, some areas, the obvious suddenly flees, and maybe this is where we need to figure out why that happens, and put back normalcy.
Mm.
You know, because I know I could sit and listen to a little 3-year-old. It would be the most fun I'd have all day. You know, if they're telling me why their red ball and their blue ball, you know, does this, and you know, I'd sit there all day. And yet why wouldn't I, like a father who's raising a family as a Muslim, how can the little one be, you know, that would be, surely should be something that you just want to sit and listen and learn.
And the thing that's beautiful about our fascination with toddlers or children, for example, who are learning to speak, you don't get really tied up about whether they're right or wrong.
We're just
fascinated with the sheer beauty of the intrigue of the way their mind is learning to work.
Yeah.
I think that's the secret, is if we can see each other the way God sees us, then we would see each other all as little toddlers. And we wouldn't hold against any of our fellows any thing they hold to be true. You know, we would just, you know, I mean, we would keep it in perspective. You know, little toddlers believe in the tooth fairy and the
right. And we even try to help them keep believing in it as long as they can.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, because in some ways that scaffolding is essential for greater beliefs. And I actually have used that with children to say, you know, well, Santa Claus is a lot like God. And because God loves all the little children and, you know, he loves to give his children good gifts. You know, I mean, you can find the essential metaphors there. I mean, and I've also said to kids, you know, Jesus is a lot like Superman. You know, and so those are, it's almost like we've invented metaphors to replace the real thing in our hearts.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
it's easier for us to grasp. And that's okay. Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's great.
But yeah, that idea of spending time with a child and just the innocence of their feelings and thoughts, you know.
Yeah, I've had that experience just recently. A friend of mine's grandson, she babysits him from time to time, and the fascinating thing about some parents in this generation, they're really taking advantage of some of the knowledge of, you know, what children can learn at an early age and, you know, the plasticity of the brain. And so this little boy, Sky by name, has learned to sign, and he's not even like 1 year old.
Oh my gosh,
so that,
wow.
So that all of a sudden now what we assumed that we had to wait till 2 or 3 until the words got out, these kids are learning to use their hands to talk. And you know, I can't understand him exactly. You know, I know some of the vocabulary. He's really fascinated with lights, and so you see the sign for light all the time and different things like that. But he's communicating on a much more, you know, a deeper level. And I think that's, there's something instructive in that too. You know, it really resonates with me what you said about, you know, if we really paid attention to, you know, a young child and what they were telling us about the world, we might really shed a lot of our jaded preconceptions that we formulated, and maybe see the world anew through their eyes.
Yeah. And I was kind of doing that metaphorically, that why not everybody? I mean, kids, yeah, but why not that Protestant if you're a Catholic, or why not that Muslim if you're an Amadeus? Or so, you know, why not, as long as it's, if it holds, it should hold. That was in addition to the infinite joy of children, but if that's the case, then it would make sense that it should always hold, kind of, if you get what I'm saying there.
Yeah. But you've been in some, you must have been in a situation a time or two where you really felt like there was some imminent danger, or maybe a serious misunderstanding about to occur. How did you,
mm-hmm.
how do you dissuade that? How did you, you know, overcome that?
You mean that I'm responsible to try to bring about some mediation and things are going south or something like that?
Well, or if you have you ever found yourself in a situation where perhaps you were being backed into a corner by that very idea that because you're a different religion, you're not as, you know, you're an apostate, say. You've been in some situations where that might, I can imagine where that might have been dangerous.
Myself. You mean that, like, most often I'm in the circumstance where I have to or I'm responsible to try to be mediating enmity between two different groups. But are you saying that my own that I'm the one who's now in danger? Is that the question?
Or I guess I'm wondering if you ever have been in that situation and how you.
I see.
What you said to defray that, or
yeah.
You know.
Well, that's interesting. That's a good question. I myself am in danger because of who and what I am, and how did I get out of it? I'm trying to think of.
Well, maybe you've never had that experience.
Maybe not. I know I've been somehow under assault, but not necessarily like classic real danger for my life or imprisonment or attack or something like that. But I think that in such circumstances, I've not been necessarily put in mortal danger over my religion or beliefs, but I have been put in mortal danger. I've had people holding me up with a gun and things like that, and as I think back on it, what I did in those circumstances. There's different approaches. One is just to try to devise some clever way to safety, but the other thing I'm trying to do quite desperately is find the humanness in the attacker and try to find some way under this kind of unusual relationship to have the attacker feel genuinely and fully respected as a human being. I think this is what was going on when I was in those circumstances. Like one time I was just lucky enough to back into too much streetlight, and then it ruined that chance for the fellow. But the other time the other couple of times when I was under mortal attack was basically my mind is racing, not mind, or my being is racing to try to see if I can get across or leap over the vicissitudes of the circumstance, like A, he's threatening me with a gun or something, and somehow get across that into have the person feel my, not invent, I mean my genuine respect and honor of him as a human being. I think that heart in which even when you're being forced to tempted to think only of yourself, to continue thinking of the other, I think proved to be helpful, or even helped escape my help my being on your show today.
an unconscious response on your part.
I like the metaphor also of backing into the light.
Yeah, I love that.
That is an interesting metaphor. I never thought of it as a metaphor, but because it was just a description of reality. That's what happened. I ended up in too much light. Normal everyday light.
It's a great. It's very apropos. And you know what you just described. Actually, I have to tell you is a technique that Jesus used all the time. He honed in on the spiritual aspect of that person, their soul, and he spoke directly to that.
You can't hate someone just because they're holding you up there. I mean, when they were six, they didn't think, that's what I want to do. They ended up there somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had that experience last February when I was living in Quebec when we last talked. I guess I was back already, but not last February, the February before, and I was held up at hammer point, of all things.
Oh, my gosh.
Hammer point.
I'd rather
two guys
be shot.
In balaclavas at 3 in the morning in Quebec in the Laurentians, and I'm there. I was working in a convenience store at the time, as a way of learning French and, after a failed relationship and all. And there I am, 3 in the morning, and, I open the door and not thinking, and these guys are yelling in a joual French, and I'm thinking they're joking with each other, and then he pushes me in the back of my shoulder, pushes some cases down, give me all your money, all that kind of thing. And it got my adrenaline up a little bit, but I realized after the fact that while I was sort of at first angry that it happened, angry that these guys were that presumptuous to do that, thinking that they ought to know better, I didn't obviously express it toward them. It took me a while to really process it and just say, okay, well, I need to give this to God. I need to give this to the God of my understanding, our Father, and have our Father process this and turn it around. And ultimately, it comes down to that realization. Somebody who does that clearly has some growing to do that they don't realize that they have to do yet.
Right.
But you said something, Frank, that I will always keep. He didn't, when he was six, he didn't think that's what he would be doing. Nobody thinks when they're 6 years old, when I grow up, I want to mug people and terrify them.
Right.
No 6-year-old would ever think that, and that is so, that's just poignant to me. I'm going to keep that one, because when people do things where they're acting out of maybe a lifetime experience of harm having been done to them, I'm going to remember that when they were six, they didn't want to grow up to do that, Nobody does.
Nobody does.
Yeah. That's a great technique. It's important, I think, to be able to see people from an objective point of view, especially in situations like that.
Yeah, and I guess there might be a lesson in that when that happens, your time of training yourself has been abruptly brought to a halt. I mean, so that's why it's good to have some sort of practice or some sort of study or prayerfulness, or like when things are normal in your day-to-day life, it's probably smart to be building up a humaneness and a spiritual impulses, because at some point you're going to be out of time to try to get that right.
Right. It's like doing the bodybuilding, before you're called to have to use your physical strength. It's the same thing, only much more important.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's like those emergency medical technicians, or people who are highly trained, and when they find themselves in a bad situation where people are injured, they kick in. Something kicks in, and it's their training. And
right.
You're right. You
training.
Know?
And people don't look at spiritual life that way. They look at it more like an obligation or just some sort of drudgery or something like that, rather than, I studied martial arts, and my thought about what I was doing was putting my brain down into my body. And, there's the classical famous Karate Kid thing, wax on, wax off, or the painting thing, so that when the attack comes, your arm does, it bypasses your brain. Your arm already does what it should do by itself. And that's what I thought about putting my brain out into my limbs, that it didn't have to go all the way up into my head. It was already, you know, it was like closer to the source of the problem or something like that. That's physical training. That, and then after the thousand, wax on, wax off, something like that, your arm already has its own knowledge. And I think that spiritual training should be looked at like that with the same kind of excitement that that suddenly when the game's afoot, that instead of your brain being out in your hand, you know, your compassion is out in your, is in your throat and is in your eyes, and it's there.
It, it goes out front. It goes before you.
On its, as a trained, it's become a habit or a reflex, or the genius is in the motion unreflected upon, unthought, uncalculated.
Wow. Yes, it's an automated response instead of something you need to stop and think about.
Mm-hmm. Right, and because there's times when there's no more time to think.
You know, last time you were on, you shared about the experience about being in a negotiation that was potentially about to go south because somebody started, you know, kind of attacking your credentials or, you know, what's this guy doing here?
Right, right.
And you called on the sort of the most holy man in the room to pray or to ask Allah whether or not this was an appropriate approach to take. And, you know, that was the clincher that, that brought the group together again. It's those types of spiritual habit patterns that you build up over a lifetime of respecting someone else's sort of their spiritual space.
Yeah, that's true.
A space for them to be safe. And I want to share real quick a quote because of what you just said, Frank and Crystalyn, too. It's from Paper 100, Religion and Human Experience. It says, religious living is devoted living, and devoted living is creative living, original and spontaneous. New religious insights arise out of conflicts, which initiate the choosing of new and better reaction habits in the place of older and inferior reaction patterns. New meanings only emerge amid conflict, and conflict persists only in the face of refusal to espouse the higher values connoted in superior meanings.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so there's that new, you know, that new habit,
right,
which you were holding up, a way to grow spiritually, and you do that by practicing wax on, wax off, you know.
It struck me exactly the same way. You beat punch ball. I was thinking of exactly that same quote. It's up on
were
the board
you really?
Now. Yeah, it's up on the board. I just posted it there. So it's really an amazing thing to think that, you know, these lessons we learn in physical life really can be applied and adapted to spiritual life if we just choose to. If we say, you know, if we acknowledge that the inner life is just as real as the outer life, and actually real in the sense that, you know, God is reaching down to pull us up or in to our inner life and realize more and more of our true nature. And, you know, that brings me to think about something that we were talking about, Frank and I, just before the show got started, and that is, that, you know, we often pray in the abstract for world peace, but if we're spiritual self-betterment and not even necessarily having to focus on ourselves, but focusing on the good of others and focus on the good of others in our immediate environment, that has that ripple effect in the rest of our life. I'm just wondering, Frank, when you think about that, how do you recommend to people, especially now in the context of your new book, Religion and Peace, the open door, what do you see as the things that people ought to be bringing into their spiritual life? What should people be praying for, and how do you see a person evolving in their relationship with God, making a difference and bringing about world peace? Maybe that's too broad, but maybe start with the first one.
Yeah, I think I know. I think I hear what you're saying, and one of the things that I think comes up early on in the book is that most things a normal and reasonable person, they're unwilling to have it done poorly in their lives, and they know that the reason why something, like, here's a couple of examples. You know, I said, how many people have been to interfaith meetings which they all begin to feel the same? Everybody's talking about how we should unite, and everybody has some new phrase or quip or something like that, why it's better to get along.
Mm-hmm.
And then I write, in what other part of your life are you willing to constantly do the same thing and see no progress, no development? Mm. Just go do the exact same thing with no progress. And so from there, my thoughts are that, and this is trying to stick with your question, is that we should look at spiritual life or look at peacemaking and things like that with a certain degree of normalcy, that even just making our eggs in the morning, we're completely unwilling to do that poorly. And someone said, I wanted to give you, you know, sunny side up, but instead I'm giving you this complete wreck of stuff that's all stuck and, you know, in a ugly mess. Nobody's willing to do it. And then you'd say, you know, it was nice of you to envision, you know, sunny side up, but how did it end up like this instead? And then the simple answer is, you didn't put any butter or olive oil. You didn't do what is needed to make it end up like that. And so then finally, you know, back to the question, if we are serious about seeking peace and reconciliation in some manner or another, whether interreligious, or if we're serious about becoming having some accomplishments for all of our spiritual labors and sacrifice, and it requires simple, normal, everyday human examination of are these reasonable things that we're doing to bring to pass our ends and goals and pursuits. So Andre asks about prayer and people constantly praying for peace, and this is what we were talking about before the show. And you and Andre mentioned, you know, rather than pray for peace, why not pray for that I myself in the next with someone close to me or the next the person I'm going to meet later actually creates adds peace to that person's life. And so back to this silly thing I just made up, instead of just all praying that my eggs are going to be fine, come out looking good, actually I should pray that I know where the butter is. because that's the particular thing. That's the difference between a nice-looking outcome and a mess. And so if you're praying for world peace, there are, like, systematic, stepwise, how can I put it, elements that contribute to that. And you can't get there without it. Does that respond at all?
Well, it does, and it begs the question then. So you've obviously thought about these elements that lead up to there, just like you've thought about, okay, well, I need to crack the eggs into the bowl, and I need to add, my pepper, my salt. I need to add a little bit of garlic and onion powder. Well, not if Crystalline's eating the eggs. She won't want to bite my onions, but I'm going to add those. I'm going to beat them up, and then I'm going to put them on a sufficiently oiled hot skillet and watch them carefully and do all of that. So it sounds, though, that you're saying with regard to peacemaking that there are certain steps we could follow, either whether on the individual level or on the level of higher conflict resolution. So what are you seeing as those steps
some of
that
those
we could
ingredients
take?
And stuff.
Yeah.
Well, one of the main ones that I'm introduced. I'm not trying to give content answers. I'm trying to provide ways of thinking. But
mm-hmm. Sure.
Good.
And so for example, if you are going to be involved in peace seeking or trying to be helpful in creating reconciled environments, the first question is, what do you think is the genesis of dystopia or conflict, or what do you think is the tension comprised of? What gives rise to it? Because nobody wants that. In fact, everybody would rather have a peaceful relationship. So if everybody wants that, why isn't it there? And so when I say that, I'm not trying to give content answers. Everybody has an answer to that. The Muslims have an answer to that. The Christians have an answer to it. But I recommend don't set out to imagine to set up a complicated or big or expensive interfaith event, and you yourself don't even have the first idea of what you believe give rise to the tension in the first place. It's like your house is flooded, and you don't bother to find where the leak is. You're going to address mm-hmm. the problem without even mm-hmm. identifying where the leak is. And that's not an intelligent approach. And so if peacemaking is your affair, or your intention or your desire or reconciliation, and like you say, even on the smallest level with someone in your own household, if you don't have a theory or a view or an idea of what's the genesis of the discord, mm-hmm. then it's very unlikely you're going to be very effective to try to make things better. So that's an example, Andre, of one ingredient. Since nobody wants it, where does the tension come from?
Right. What a great phrase, the genesis of the discord.
Oh,
looking at the origin
of the
problem.
It's nature and gravity.
Yeah.
Discern its nature and gravity, right? You know, I have to say that I think that much of the troubles of the world come from just that. We are constantly trying to put out fires rather than trying to find what's starting the fires. Or we're always searching for the cure without searching for the cause.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, if we could find the cause, you know, I always think of they run for the cure, you know. Well, let's run for the cause. If we find the cause, then we'll be able to, you know, find the cure.
And then what will happen is someone will say, no, that's not the cause. And another one will say, no, this is the cause. There might be a Muslim version of what's the cause. There might be a Christian version. But then say... Then you can be in conversation about beginning to work together to address the problem. Mm. And the Muslim will say, we were all with God, all present with God, and then when we descended into our embodiment, we forgot that knowledge of our oneness with God. Okay, so it was forgetfulness. I'm being simplistic here, but it's accurate. Forgetfulness is in Islam, one of the primary causes of being separated from God and therefore prone to our sinfulness or aggressions or whatever, forgetfulness. Because in the presence of God, there's nothing but delight and harmony. Okay, that's that. Then there's a Christian point of view, where the Genesis tale, the book of Genesis, talks about an act of disobedience. So there's somehow, not forgetfulness, but disobedience is what brought human beings into a condition or state whereby we are prone to this kind of bad behavior. So then you get two different groups that's saying, no, it's forgetfulness. We're all souls were with God all at the origin, and the Christian says, no, it's disobedience that the first human beings, blah blah blah. But at least there you're talking about a cause, and it's not hard, honestly not hard, for a Christian and a Muslim with what seem like irreconcilable views to say, well, wasn't there some form of forgetfulness that would help support an eventual act of disobedience? I mean, well, yeah, that makes sense. Or isn't there some mm-hmm. isn't there an element of disobedience that is somehow attached to the condition of forgetfulness? Well, of course, obviously, and so the differences are they're in dialogue and in support. And say, if I were a Christian, I would never try to only just advance the cure based on a blinders on narrow understanding of what I understand the cause to be. I know I have some access to some truth about the cause, but as a limited soul in a single tradition, it's impossible for me to know all the different elements. So I would always want a Muslim to say, listen, I'm seeing it this way, this is how I'm, you know, this is the approach I want to take. And my Muslim friend will say, yeah, that's brilliant. I would never have thought of that. But don't forget this, because of his habits of his traditions and his belief about the origins of dystopia. Do you get what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And so when I say know what you believe is the cause, it doesn't mean that finally I've examined it, I've meditated on it, and now I know it's this. You know, it says right here in the Bible. You know, it's not you still have to know what you believe, but it doesn't mean that just because you finally get in touch with that, you don't need the help of all your fellow believers and fellow religionists. And so these are a few of the little things. And then go ahead.
Well, I hate to interrupt, but we had a good question on the board, and I'd like to get it in if I could. So based on what you were just saying, our friend Bro Dave on the board would like to know, how can we get to this place where we all agree who or what is the authority? And is that even, you know, an issue?
Yeah, and this is what I was hinting at. It's the identification or identity of the authority that is maybe the clearest and strongest irreconcilable element. You can't point to Jesus and insist he's Muhammad. He's not. He is who he is. And Muhammad is who he is. And so for those people whose lives are in, you know, unassailable certitude that the authority is Jesus, or unassailable certitude that the authority is the prophet. It does not make sense to try to solve that before you can get started, or else you simply will never get started. And what I say to that, or how I've approached it, and it's only just me, is there is something that there is enough that's common that we can leave the authority question shelved or always with us, and never going soft on who and what we're passionate about. Always, never going soft. Always with us. But there's enough in common that we don't have to solve that before getting started. And here's what we have in common. Something like, do you have an 8-year-old girl? Yes. So do I. Or my girl is 7 years old. Do you want things to go well for her? Yes. Would you like her to get a good education? Yes. If she ever gets married, would you like her husband to honestly care for her and respect her? Yes. I mean, there's enough absolutes that I wouldn't say we're ready to die for. Maybe we're ready to die for. And then in the middle of these, yes, 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 yes. And would you give everything? Would you give every last thing you have right at this moment if it could guarantee that the man that marries that little girl of yours someday cares for her like, you know, like no one's ever been cared for? Yes, of course. I'd give everything I have okay. And do you believe that Jesus is Lord? No. No. Okay. Let's leave that one. It's okay, you know. There's enough that we can, let's both, you know, there's enough that is, in the world of absolutes, that we know we're one and the same, that we can hug and cry every time we meet. So that's the way I'd respond to our guest, our friend who posted the question. Mm-hmm. They're not to go soft on. When I say suspend, they're not so that we, you know, why can't we all get along and you know, appear on, you know, Access Hollywood? That's not we can be absolute and unbending and know that every word of the Quran is dictated and nobody's going to tell me otherwise. Fine. If be however one wants to be in terms of the authority that guides our lives. But I know surely that there's enough absolute shared humanness that can carry us over those times of where the authority might invite us to stay separate. It's unwise and unnecessary.
You know, if having to agree on even the authority of text or the authority of God was going to be the clearinghouse or the fixing point, we wouldn't have so much division within religion.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
We have enough divisions within faith traditions who can't
exactly
agree on these points.
Yeah.
I've never
exactly
been able
right
to agree on these points. We'll probably never be able to agree on these points. That making those points the place where we start is obviously not the right place to go.
It's a non-starter
yeah
in the sense of
it's a non-starter.
Peace. Yeah,
that's
in the
right
sense of peace, it won't start peace, but it will start conflict. That's probably the, you know, if you want to start on what we disagree in, well, let's start with conflict. You know, let's set off with a conflict from the get-go. You know, if we're going to start there. But that idea that we have absolutes, and I, you know, I'd like to kind of go back to your egg analogy too, that, you know, well, you know, Frank, I like my eggs over easy. Therefore, you must have, you know, if I am going to make you some eggs, I'm going to ask you, how do you like your eggs? Because there's a lot of different ways you can have your eggs. And if I'm a caring and loving person, I'm going to knock myself out to really make you your eggs the way you like them. And I'm not going to insist that you have your eggs the way I like
them.
Yeah,
that's a good one. That's a good one. I like that one. Yeah.
Or if you don't like eggs, I'm not going to serve you eggs, you know. I'm going to try to get something. But I love your reaching for that humanness, because I have done that with some success, to say to somebody, do you have children? Yes. And, you know, because do you want your children to, you know, go to college when they graduate from high school? Well, of course. You know,
you
find those things that that they can say yes to. It makes it a much easier conversation, especially if someone wants to contend. But here's an observation that I've made about you, Frank, and I think is probably one of the secrets to your success. You don't express your personal beliefs a lot, do you?
No, actually, that's true, because they strike... This may sound silly, but I've always thought that whatever I believe is just some guy's opinion. It's the best, you know, that's all. It happens to be, the guy happens to be me, just as it turns out, but it's still just some guy's view. So, that's how I... that's why I'm not that anxious to always be spotty. Unless somebody asks what's my point of view, then I'll try my best to explain. But I do wanna honor and respect your callers, your listeners' question, because it is the right question. I think Crystal and I were talking about that last night, about this girl in an interfaith course she took, who really said, I don't think everything's the same, it's true, and so I don't think people need to go soft or mushy in order to work with all of our hearts in love together.
Well, it does seem like for many of us who've been involved in the interfaith world for a while, we do get used to a certain expectation for mushiness.
Yeah.
That's sort of one of the givens of that group, or has been in the past for a long time. And
right.
I was describing one of my interfaith teachers who was shocked to find one of his students saying, no, I'm not willing to agree that we're all the same. I'm not willing to agree that all of our beliefs are equal.
Equally true, or whatever.
Equally true.
Mm.
Because I don't believe that. I mean, I would be pretending or lying if I told you that that's how I saw the world, or that I was even willing to go there as a place to start. I'm not willing to say that I don't believe what I believe. I continue to believe what I believe, but I'm still willing and committed to the interfaith dialogue process.
Hmm.
And that really sort of shook him up. And what I was saying to Frank is, his being really shaken up by that gave me great satisfaction. Because I do feel like we need to respect people's ability to continue to see the world the way they see the world. To not expect everybody to give up their point of view in order to get along.
I don't want to give up my point of view in order to get along. I want you to accept me with my point of view. Even
and
if
you
it's... And I'll accept you with
right.
yours.
Right. That's, to me, the beautiful mosaic of humanity. That's what makes us interesting, fascinating. You know, how horrible, how boring would it be if we all thought alike? We'd be automatons, you know, I mean.
Well, I'm
we
going
wouldn't...
back to Frank's earlier analogy about men and women. Like, can you imagine if part of the marriage vows had the elimination of the gender difference?
Yeah.
I agree to go forward in this marriage that I will become a man. In order to get along with you, I will transform myself into being the person of another gender.
Right, that would sort of dishonor the whole creative initiative of God in the first place, who apparently values this diversity. And so then it becomes, why is it we can't understand that? Why is it we can't pay attention to that? And I think it gets back to, Frank, your point that we really have to get out of this idea of having ideas of what can work without actually seeing what actually does work, and pay attention to who our brothers and sisters really are with their differences and begin to see how can we function with those differences. And even if I don't think that your way is going to get me further to God, can I acknowledge that you think that your ideas and your precepts about God will get you to God? That each person's precepts are a stepping stone toward God if there is sincerity. And I'm not there to judge your sincerity any more than you're there to judge my sincerity. I need to just take that on faith and maybe only if it's blatant and it's getting in the way of the harmony of all of us progressing toward more harmony and good. So, you know, I'm really curious about how this is developing in your mind, Frank. And I went to your blog here, and I'm looking forward to seeing parts of your book up there, because it seems to me that you've got some remarkable ideas about and practical ideas about how we can go forward and bring
thanks.
About world peace.
Well, thanks. Thanks for going there and taking a look. I think one of the things is that there's a little bit of how can I put it? Selling the hope for interfaith short. That people are looking at it as kind of how can we tape or glue the fender on this car so that these differences, you know, I just don't want them in the way, honestly. But I think that it should be more a celebration that once I've begun in the process of a genuine interfaith life, that I wouldn't dream of trying to do anything without asking my Muslim friends, without asking like all of you on this show, command the texts of the Urantia teachings so well that I'd be dumb not to give you a call if I were doing something important, because I can only know as much as I know. So I want to have a Hindu friend. I want, like, so that these differences yes, as you say, Andre, yes, I trust and hope they're going to get you to heaven. But I don't even have that much distance or that much, I don't allow that much distance in my approach to whatever it is they believe. Because I know this guy. He's a brilliant man. He's a kind man. He's a good man. So his beliefs can't be that negligible. There's got to be something there. Mm-hmm. And so an increase of interfaith is something I need more and more and more. I'm not good enough at being a Muslim, but I know there's something in there that I might be missing. And that's what our dialogue can be. It can be like having a friend who's really good at when your computer breaks down or something like that. Give a call, call and say, I can't get this paragraph to paginate or something like that. That's what we're here for each other.
Mm-hmm. And part of what I hear you saying, or what it sounds like you're saying too, is that you have invested the time to get to know someone.
Yes.
To be able to respect their level of genius in X arena or Y arena. You see the employment of years of cultivating wisdom or habit, spiritual habit patterns, or those things which religion attempts to grow in people.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I don't, if I go to an Episcopalian church or something like that, yeah, it's easy for me to be around Episcopalians. That's, we're similar in lots of ways. We laugh at the same jokes and have the same, annual meetings, and that's great. There's nothing wrong with that. But I don't really need them that much to complement my spiritual life. Because I already know that fairly well if I am an Episcopalian. But what I really don't know is that Jain point of view, or that Yoruba point of view. And so that's why it's worth the extra effort to stretch ourselves in that way, because the benefit, the add-on to yourself, the complement to what you lack, is better, is more abundant. A fellow Episcopalian, if I were an Episcopalian, a fellow Episcopalian is, yeah, they are a complement, but it's not that abundant. I already know that fairly well. I've been that all my life, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I want to share a quote from Jesus, just because it's so poignant to what we've been talking about here in the last few minutes. He says to his apostles, when they were amazed by his tolerance of a Greek's propositions, he says to them, "My children, marvel not that I was tolerant of the Greek's philosophy. True and genuine inward certainty does not in the least fear outward analysis, nor does truth resent honest criticism. You should never forget that intolerance is the mask covering up the entertainment of secret doubts as to the trueness of one's belief. No man is at any time disturbed by his neighbor's attitude when he has perfect confidence in the truth of that which he wholeheartedly believes.
Right.
Courage is the confidence of thoroughgoing honesty about those things which one professes to believe. Sincere men are unafraid of the critical examination of their true convictions and noble ideals.
And that's fantastic.
Well, that's yeah. Jesus. I mean, you know, but you know, we know really so little about him, but in an interfaith sense, I think that he was the original interfaith champion. And he was truly interested in every person and what they thought and what they did. Truly interested in them, sincerely interested in them, and willing to listen to them and learn about them and hear them out. And, you know, I love that concept that intolerance is the mask covering up the entertainment of secret doubts. That if someone poses something to what you were pointing out, that it actually, when they believe differently, that adds something to you. That gives you something that you didn't already have. You can hang out with like minds all the time and never be challenged or stimulated to know more. But
right.
Human beings are amazing.
And to benefit all that much more.
Yeah.
Well,
it's like, yeah,
but
it's
we
like,
also...
I'm sorry,
go ahead. Sorry, you go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's like having somebody already on 8th Avenue when you were planning to use that as your route, and you're on 6th, and he says, don't come up here, I'm telling you, there's cars as far as you can see. And that's what having your people on all your outposts, having a Muslim out there, and it can only do you good.
Right.
If you go there, there'll be dragons.
It's not a good. And you know what? That is the best in humanity, that we want to share good things with each other and good information. You know, we take for granted that, you know, sometimes misery loves company, but joy craves fellowship. And when something makes us happy or when something helps us avoid a problem, we gladly share that, freely share that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best thing about us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and when we look at, let's say a natural disaster or a crisis that is really huge, overwhelmingly huge, what is human nature like then? What almost universally happens then? Last time we were talking about Syria and the fact that there were talks going on, you know, sort of almost simultaneously with our show. And you had expressed concern about the depth of that challenge, the intensity of that challenge being sort of so bad.
Right.
That the only way for it to work would be for all of the major players to do something radically different from what they'd ever done before.
Yes.
And I think about how big national disasters or international disasters in some cases cause people from all faiths to pull together.
Mm.
All of a sudden, whatever we were fighting about last week is totally irrelevant because there's this outpouring of concern and consideration for the suffering that is occurring around us.
Yes.
Or that we can see on the news or that, you know, is just so devastating. And what is it about that that brings out the willingness for people to, you know, forget whatever it was that they were?
You know, it's interesting. Oh, I'm sorry, I don't want to.
No, I'm done.
It's very interesting. I would get a new thought from what you just raised because And why people are addicted to these kind of disasters is because when a disaster strikes, we are reduced to the most basic of our humanity, and our commonness is laid bare, inescapably bare, before our eyes. And so it's the gift of commonness that the tragedy of these disasters provides. But when one has to make the little bit of effort, like I invented that conversation between two people, one with an 8-year-old daughter, one with a 7-year-old daughter,
mm-hmm.
all it takes is a little bit of effort to find that commonness, but there's something that obstructs or prevents that in our when it's not forced on us. And these disasters make our basic oneness so inescapably plain before us that
mm-hmm.
we can, on those occasions, finally, and it's a weird word to say, enjoy the true given of being everything we're meant to be, caring, loving, compromising, sacrificing, etc. And so, you know, I don't want to sound cynical or something like that, but there's a little bit of great attraction to any kind of disaster out of the need to have this commonness felt when a disaster isn't necessary if there were the type of education which helps us get to that all the time. So that's a couple of my thoughts on that as you were speaking. Like, for example, I talked about trying to find the commonness with the guy that's holding me up with the gun. That's not the place you ordinarily look for it. But then when there's, like, people starving and suffering and no place to live or something, suddenly all the irrelevance and the insignificance of the differences we make such a big deal out of, they're not there anymore. You can't. And so, anyway, we should train ourselves to be able to transcend those, not only in emergency and
right.
So
yeah, it's another habit.
Yeah, as we're winding down the second hour here, it's occurring to me that while I don't want a panacea from you, Frank. I am interested in getting your
sure you do.
if there's a magic bullet here, magic formula, magic potion, great. But we've been talking. I just admire the pragmatism in a lot of what you're talking about, and it's a spiritual pragmatism, which is I think the way it needs to go, and. Despite there being a little, well, in any event, I don't regard it as cynical at all. Much of what you're talking about is just realism about the fact that we've got some very, very intractable problems here. So my two questions to you would be, one seems like a panacea, and that is, what can we each do to move one step closer to world peace today? And maybe a question to address before that is, what do you see as the greatest threat to world peace today?
Curiously, I actually do have a response or thoughts on these things. What to do to advance toward world peace is my answer, I don't know if I sound a little bit of a fundamentalist, but anyway, if there's something you believe or some system you're a part of, like, say, I'm a Baptist or whatever, or if take seriously where you find yourself in terms of your spiritual practice, even if you're secular. Even if you're an atheist, whatever you have collected around you that you can recognize as a guide for how you should be. Take that seriously and set time aside each day to examine yourself over against where your teachings lie. If you're a Christian, what Jesus asks of us. If you're a follower of Oprah Winfrey, what she says is a good thing. It doesn't matter. But whatever you've picked as your root source of where you think people ought to be like that, and put yourself in front of that stuff on a regular, consistent basis every day, as close as much as you can, at the same time every day. And turn off everything and sit there with whoever and whatever is your guide system. And it could be something as, you could be the highest spiritual person alive. You could be the Dalai Lama. You could be the Pope. It doesn't matter. On a given, every single day you can, as close as possible to the same time, sit in front of what is your root source of how you think people ought to be, and look at where you did good, look at where you did wrong, look at what you want to fix, look at what you want to try, look at what you want to try again, and so on and so forth. That's what I believe is the way everyone can contribute to world peace, is get in the practice of taking seriously where you find yourself in your in terms of your spiritual light, your spiritual truth, your spiritual guide, your spiritual hunches, your spiritual teachers, your priests, your rabbis, whatever. Take it seriously and do it every day. And turn off everything and do that seriously. That I believe will contribute to world peace. And in terms of the greatest threat, I had a thought when, let me think. I believe that love inside of family, and I stretch it to include friends, is the place where somehow the universe has built things so that it's given that family love, it's just some random individual like a little running around your house, but somehow you think it's your brother or your mom, or I don't know, it's just a given. And so that's the place where human-heartedness and the education of human-heartedness is the arena. And I think anything in the entertainment world, in the business world, in the political, anything that threatens the sanctity and the potential for households and family to be close and around each other, I think is a threat to world peace, because that's the automatic place that every human being on earth has. And I know there's a lot of dysfunction, I know this, but the threat to healthy family is the threat to world peace. That's my point of view.
Wow. That's brilliant. Everybody would look at, they'd look first to, Putin or Assad, or they'd look to some leader, but I think you're really hitting it exactly where it is, Frank. It's at the roots. If somebody comes out of a good family, they are much less able to be assailed by a world that is not at peace with itself.
Mm-hmm. Or they're much less likely to be in a Putin or Assad or whoever you want to identify as a bad guy.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's excellent. Thank you for that, Jim. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for the great question, Andre.
Yeah,
that, we could do a whole show about just those two things, and your own spiritual practice, and I really got lost in that, Frank. Thanks so much. That was great.
Really,
that was great.
Really clearly stated that anything that threatens that for anyone, anywhere in the world,
is a good place to start when we're looking for that cause or that that underlying threat or feeling of threat, threatened, being threatened.
Well, and you know, ultimately we think we're threatened.
Because that's that universal jagstone. Sorry, what?
No, go ahead. What were you saying? That's not universal?
I said that's kind of the universal touchstone.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, Frank had said earlier that oftentimes we do our religious thing out of obligation, a sense of duty. And I think there's another great motivation, and that is as a bribe. You know what I mean? We think God needs to be bribed, that we can purchase magical rewards or avoid punishments by just doing this thus and so. And so, you know, but it's really not how it works. It's about being who you are, the best person you can be. And I truly believe that the world will change when each person transforms. But it has to happen at that level. It's not going to be because we overthrew a despot, because there's always another one waiting to take his place. The despot has to change fundamentally himself, and that happens, you know. I mean, Bro Dave, again, on the board, you know, pointed out that children don't really get a fair chance, and we're going back to the six-year-old now, you know. He didn't want to. He didn't think he was going to grow up to be a despot, you know.
Right.
Put it on his life goals.
Yeah. And so what happened? But somewhere he didn't get what he needed to live his life every day.
I just thought of
spiritual practice.
I just thought of a kid coming home with a stick figure in red and yellow crayon and pink, and the mommy's about to put it on the fridge and says, "What's that, Johnny?" He said, "Oh, it's a despot."
My hero.
Yeah.
Hero, yeah. That's what I want to be when I grow up.
Right. Well, you know, assuming that you know, perhaps one of those families was a family that actually did succumb to the threat against the home, it begs the question, turning that whole proposition around, what can we do to minimize, you know, the threat to the education of human-heartedness in the home? What can we do to minimize the threat against the sanctity of the home, which is really going to be the nurturing place for the attitude of love and world peace?
I think that's where vocation comes in. That's where calling comes in. Some person might write a song with lyrics that, you know, that puts up a good defense in some home. Some person might say that between 3 and 6 p.m., when no parents are home and all children are home, there is a string of television shows which relativizes and mocks everything sacred about family. For three, so, and someone might be called to address that. I think it's when you ask what one does to, I think that's where vocation and calling are. You know, somebody might be a big brother type that plays baseball with the kids, and the last thing he says every day is, "Go give your mom a hug and ask your dad if there's something he wants you to do." You know, it's your calling. It's anyone has a place. Everyone has a place where they can either, you know, meet, you know, tough edge, you know, challenge ABC television on their program, you know, all the way to, you know, as I say, be a big brother that plays softball. It's where you're called. It's what you can do.
Well, I'm really looking forward to, thank you for that idea, and I'm looking forward to seeing how you develop these ideas in your new book coming out.
Me too.
I know it's still in process, but again, that's religion and peace, the open door. Do you want to just say a little bit about how you see that developing and what anything that you're still working on developing in that book, Frank?
No, it's basically complete, and it just needs the hours I need to write it out. It grows out of the fact that I had doctoral students with me for 40 hours in a row, and I spoke for 40 hours in a row. Or not, you know, I mean, it was a dialogical situation, but basically, it's there, and it's and that's what gave me the courage, or finally get over my own whatever, you know, procrastination, whatever was in my way. So now I'm just writing it out, and you can see it. You can see the writing piece by piece, not full, but when you go to the site called Kaufman on Interfaith, you'll see the book unfolding. I think, is that where you went, Andre?
I think so. I mean, I'm excited about the fact that you're sharing your process with us too, because I'm also a procrastinating writer.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And I appreciate the fact that you're sharing the process along the way as well. That's so cool.
Yeah. Oh, good. Yeah, that's good. I didn't think of that, but that's good. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thanks for coming on today and, you know, sharing this with us. And it's just been delightful to have you on and your insights and your experience. Invaluable.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for giving us all your time.
Once again, you've made 2 hours fly by.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah, it's been enjoyable. It's great to be with people of real purpose and conscientious like yourselves.
Well, Thank you.
Well, we look forward to trying to put into practice some of your ideas, and I think that's really what we want to leave our listeners with today, is that this wasn't just an intellectual exercise. This wasn't just, you know, interviewing you, you know, for the sake of hearing the wonderful sweetness which is there of Frank Kaufman. It really is about, you know, what is a step that each one of us can take to help bring about peace in the world. And it's not just peace, that it's underscored by love is what I hear. And we need to bring that about, we need to work on ourselves in that way that you said. You know, if I have a faith in God, if I have a particular faith tradition, what can I do to carve out the time to really be serious about it and to say, I really will give myself over to God in my inner life and hear what he has to say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I really appreciate the fact that you broadened that horizon to include anyone and everyone, regardless of even whether they are a person of faith.
Right.
Like even if you're an atheist, there's some touchstone that is for you the highest that you can shoot for.
Yeah.
That all of those goals or those images of perfection are worthy of devotion. Of spending time really devoting to that improvement.
Let's
give those efforts as much focus as we would give our eggs.
At least.
At least.
Yeah. Beautiful analogy. I think we'll all go away remembering that one. That's a great one, Frank.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I'll never make eggs the same way again.
That's right.
But I will always think of that.
And make them with peace.
That's
there
right.
You go.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Thank you very much.
Will you come on again when you got your book done? We'll help you promote it.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, anytime
okay.
You call, I'm happy to be with you. It's my pleasure.
You're awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well,
on that happy note, I guess we're going to have to say goodbye.
Okay,
thanks for listening, friend.
Yeah, thank you.
We'll be back next time. Thank you, Frank. God bless.
Thanks, all. Bye-bye.
Have
God
a wonderful
bless.
Weekend.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You
too. You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.